Thousands of women are gathering in Portland, Oregon for the Grace Hopper celebration. It is the world's largest technical conference for women in computing, and there's a lot of recruiting going on. High-tech companies are discovering design teams with men and women often create better products. But as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, there aren't nearly enough women to meet the demand.
Katie Schmaltz-Reed, a graduate student at Stanford, recalls one of her very first classes at the university, Computer Science 106A.
That was definitely a very good introduction into women in tech. There weren't very many women in the class. I very distinctly remember being the only girl in my section.
It's no secret that beginning in middle school, young women often lose interest in science and math. So it's not surprising that relatively few women sign up for computer courses in college. And when they do, they're often at a huge disadvantage.
I remember the guy on the first day sitting next to me. He was telling me how he had coded up a search engine. And I'm sitting there like, are you kidding me? I've never coded anything. This is like day one introduction.
Katie Schmaltz-Reed was able to catch up, but says by the second semester, fewer than half the original women were still in the course. Nationwide, only about 20% of the bachelor's degrees in computer science go to women. And Mark Bregman, the former chief technology officer at Symantec, says for the industry, it's not nearly enough.
One of the things that's a barrier to our ability to grow is our ability to hire the best talent. If we could get more women to go into computer science, we would have more talent to hire from.
Bregman, who's now a senior executive at a company called Neustar, says there's an acute shortage of computing talent. He not only worries about the small number of women coming in the door, but also about the industry's inability to retain them. They leave their technical jobs far more often than men. Bregman cites empirical and anecdotal evidence that teams with men and women are often more productive and build stuff that's more interesting. Take Symantec's effort to develop software to limit what kids could see and do on the internet.
The initial engineering approach was we will just block the bad stuff. And through some of the internal discussion, it became clear that, well, that's not really going to work because the kids are going to get around it. And so rather than do that, why not create a product which enhances the dialogue between the parents and the children about what is safe behavior on the internet? That's very different than the hard and fast engineering-driven, I'll use the term male, approach, which just says no, yes or no.
In an effort to bring in more women, Bregman began requiring hiring managers to interview women for engineering jobs, even if on paper they weren't as strong as the male candidates. And once in the door, the women often demonstrated their worth and got the jobs. Other companies have their own initiatives. Here at Facebook, sun-drenched offices in Silicon Valley, you'll find nursing rooms and premium parking slots for pregnant women. But Jocelyn Goldfein, a director of engineering, says there are far more substantial efforts to hire and retain women.
One of the things Facebook has that I love, I arrived here too late to take advantage of it, is the parental leave. Facebook offers 4 months of paid parental leave, not just to women, but also to men. And because the men are taking it, it's not this abnormal thing that only affects the one person in the team who's a woman.
Over time, that should help women whose careers have often been derailed when they took time off to have kids. But there's something quietly insidious happening in many high-tech companies. Women engineers, more often than men, end up in testing or project management. Those positions usually pay less and carry less status, so moving up the career ladder becomes more difficult. And when women aren't promoted, they are more likely to leave. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Today we're going to talk about a proposal to make your cell phone fair game for robocalls. As federal law stands now, automatic dialers are prohibited from calling wireless phones, that is, unless you give your consent. But a bill before Congress would change that, and joining us to talk about it is Randall Strauss. He's written about the bill in his digital domain column for the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
And Randall, what type of calls would be allowed under this proposed legislation that we're talking about? Would telemarketers, for example, be allowed?
Telemarketing calls would remain forbidden, but it would define permissible calls as anything that isn't a telemarketing call. So if a business were to call you for any reason other than making a direct pitch, it would now be permitted as long as you had, at some point, given your cell phone number to the business.
It sounds from reading your column, Randall, that you think this proposed law is a bad idea. You do not think that robocalls should be allowed to go through to cell phones, right?
That's true. I am concerned that this bill would make it possible for someone to hand over their phone number without realizing that in doing so, they're going to receive calls that they might not want to receive in the future.
And the argument in favor of this, of allowing robocalls to reach cell phones, is what? And it's coming from whom?
There is a group of trade groups led by the financial services industry, groups such as the American Bankers Association and the Mortgage Bankers Association and the trade group that represents collections agencies, that would like to clarify that the very act of giving a business your phone number, your cell phone number, constitutes consent for not just the immediate purpose, but for future purposes.
So in other words, if you use your number for any sort of transaction under the proposed law, that would mean any business that has that number in the future could keep using it, could keep calling you.
Correct. They say all calls that are not a telemarketing call are what they describe as an informational call, which sounds very innocuous, doesn't it?
Sounds innocuous, but consumer groups are really concerned about it. They call the change a wolf in sheep's clothing. What's their argument about that?
Well, all sorts of things could fall under informational calls. So they range from the welcome kind of call, your pharmacy calling you to say your prescription's ready. But there are also other kinds of calls that are not telemarketing calls that might not be so welcome. So collections agencies, for example, would be able to call and leave a message saying you owe a lot of money, and they can make those calls, presumably, every day.
You know, it's interesting because the cell phone industry says that the law, which goes back 20 years, is really out of date with the way we use cell phones now, that things have changed. We pay for our cell phone service in different ways, so incoming calls don't pose the same financial burden that they did before. Do they have a point with that?
I think this would be a stronger argument if it had been made a few years ago compared to now. But what we're seeing is more and more people are not using their phones to speak with. And the cell phone isn't really just like a landline phone without a tether. It's a much more personal phone. It goes with us wherever we are. So a call that comes in is going to interrupt us literally wherever we are. And that isn't the case with the landline phone that sits on the kitchen counter.
I've been talking with Randall Strauss, who writes the Digital Domain column for the New York Times. He's also a professor of business at San Jose State University. Mr. Strauss, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A lot of video gamers had to drag themselves back into the real world today after a big weekend in front of their screens. Sales broke records last week as two new games hit the stores. The new version of Call of Duty sold 6 million copies. That's a game that falls in the category known as first-person shooters. And fantasy role-playing fans bought 3 million copies of the new version of Elder Scrolls. It's called Skyrim. Beth Accomando of member station KPBS reports.
My 18-year-old son, Tony Weidinger, spent the last 3 days fighting infinite dragons. And this morning, he sounded wiped out.
Picked up Elder Scrolls Skyrim on Friday at about 1 in the morning. And I've been playing all weekend. It's now 5:30 Monday morning, and I've played about 20 hours.
Skyrim is the fifth installment in the fantasy role-playing game, The Elder Scrolls. Players fight all sorts of magical and monstrous enemies, including plenty of dragons. The prospect of such an adventure had my son all revved up last Thursday night as he went to wait in line for the game.
We got there at 10, so we figured that we would at least get a good position in line. We did. We're like fifth, sixth. Come home, set up two TVs, two systems with two different games, and play them until our bodies give out or we have to leave.
That was a typical plan of attack for most of the people waiting in line at the GameStop in the San Diego suburbs. Like my son and his friend, David Petruzza was planning to dedicate his weekend to Skyrim.
Oh, for a game like this, you should more or less just say goodbye to your life now. You know, wife, kids, job, bills, bye.
I'm going to play like 24 hours and then drink a Mountain Dew to keep me up and then play another 24 hours.
Kira Morales was one of the few female gamers in line. But everyone was excited about the rare opportunity of picking up a new release on a Friday before a three-day weekend with nothing to distract them from going home and immediately playing their new game. Modern Warfare 3, on the other hand, came out at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, says 17-year-old Cameron Martin. And a lot of gamers had to choose between sleeping, school, and blowing people away online.
I hear a lot of students came down with Modern Warfare-itis Tuesday.
The attendance office at Cameron's school couldn't verify a spike in absenteeism, but they laughed and said they would start paying more attention to the gaming release schedule. Teachers reported a lot of bleary-eyed students who could barely drag themselves to class on Tuesday after late-night sessions of Modern Warfare 3.
Watch and learn.
So if your kid or coworker was a little slow today or couldn't quite focus, Skyrim or Modern Warfare 3 might be the culprit. For NPR News, I'm Beth Accomando.
Now to the wild frontier of e-books. Today, Amazon began shipping the latest iteration of its e-reader called the Kindle Fire. And the company is not only selling books for these devices, Amazon has also introduced a lending library. But as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some publishers and authors were taken aback to find that their books were part of the lending program.
If you go to the main webpage of Amazon's lending library, you'll see a display of covers that includes some very popular books: The Hunger Games trilogy, Moneyball, A Reliable Wife.
Well, I was rather startled to be included.
Robert Gulrich is the author of A Reliable Wife. He never gave permission for his book to be included in the lending library, but then again, he didn't necessarily have to.
You know, if any bookstore bought 20 copies of my book, they would be entitled to give it away to whoever they wanted. So in a retail environment, it's very hard to tell them what to do with my book.
But Amazon can't include just any book in its lending library. The six major publishing houses have negotiated a way of selling their e-books to Amazon that precludes using them in a lending library without permission. Smaller houses who sell their e-books wholesale to the retailer don't have that protection. Rachel Deal of Publishers Weekly says Amazon approached publishing houses last summer with different deals. Most said no, but that didn't stop Amazon from including some of those publishers' titles without telling them.
That's got to be frustrating, and it's got to be, on some level, embarrassing to have to go to your authors and say, "We didn't know this was happening. We're sorry."
It's a tricky situation for publishers, says Deal, because Amazon sells so many books, and that makes it hard for anyone to speak up on the subject.
It gives you a sense of just how scared publishers are of Amazon, because nobody will come out and say, this is a problem and we're angry about it.
Literary agents are speaking out. Brian DeFiore of the Association of Authors Representatives says his organization wants to know how authors will be compensated if Amazon begins making deals with the larger publishing houses. They're also concerned that Amazon is simply using books to sell Kindles.
Giving away someone's creative work as an incentive to buy some other service or product, it feels, whether it's legal or not, it certainly feels problematic.
Writer Robert Gulrich has another worry: the effect Amazon's lending library may have on independent bookstores. No one, says Gulrich, can compete with free.
Reliable Wife would never, ever have become a bestseller without the support and hand-selling of independent booksellers. And I think anything that weakens independent booksellers weakens the entire literary discourse in the country, and I'm all for a healthy and vibrant literary discourse.
And here's another sign of Amazon's pervasive influence in the book industry. Gulrich himself is a member of Amazon Prime, and that, of course, makes him eligible to use the lending library. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Some other news now. Amazon shot off the latest round in the computer tablet wars yesterday, the Kindle Fire. The company ended up shipping the device a day earlier to get it in the hands of buyers a bit sooner. It's sleek, looks a little like an iPad with a touch screen, but the Fire costs $300 less than the iPad. Another major difference between the iPad and its younger, cheaper cousin is that Amazon is selling this new tablet at a loss. That means the Kindle Fire costs more to make than it costs to buy. NPR's Zoe Chase of our Planet Money team has this look at how the company plans to make money.
If you wanted a tablet and sat out from the iPad frenzy because it cost too much or the line was too long, Amazon has a message for you. You can't afford not to get this one.
Amazon is trying to put a storefront in your hands for which they're willing to more or less give it away.
Andrew Rasweiler knows what he's talking about because he's one of the only people in the world who can speak confidently about how much it costs Amazon to make one of these things. He does what are called teardowns for the research firm IHS iSupply, and it's exactly what it sounds like.
It's really hard to tell until you've taken a screwdriver to it.
Is that what you guys do? You actually, like, rip it apart with your bare hands?
There's no other way.
Obviously, the Kindle Fire just came out yesterday, so Andrew hasn't been able to tear the thing apart. But they did a preliminary estimate, adding up things like the touchscreen, the memory, the battery, based on the other tablets they've ripped apart in the past.
$209 for materials and manufacturing.
Amazon sells the Kindle Fire for $199, but they're out much more than $10 on each of the Fires, because Rasweiler's estimate doesn't include the licensing deals that Amazon cuts to stream content or the marketing costs, so that we all knew the Fire was coming out this week.
For Kindle and Amazon, it's very similar to the business model of service providers like AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon.
Phone companies that sell the actual phones at a loss, but make up for it when they lock you into that contract. That is exactly what Amazon hopes to do. Once you're inside their ecosystem, there are a whole bunch of ways they can make money off of you. You buy their books, their movies, their music, you're locked in. There's no Apple store on an Amazon device. Amazon is basically spending $10 to buy your loyalty. The loyalty will turn a profit. Eduardo Porter has written about this strategy in his book, The Price of Everything.
Printers and printer ink. One very common tactic of printer manufacturers is to sell printers very, very cheap and printer ink very expensive.
Get it? $40 printer seems like a steal. It will last for a long time. It's fancy and high tech. But a printer without ink is useless. And you have to buy the ink that goes with that particular brand of printer, HP ink or Canon ink. And the ink will run you
$4,731 a gallon. That's the price of 1985 vintage Krug champagne.
Do you purchase those often?
No, I do not.
Amazon didn't start out as a computer company, unlike, say, Apple. For Amazon, the computer is simply a means to an end.
Amazon was a store that just happened to be online, and you can get at it on whatever device you wanted.
Primarily a bookstore at first. And though Amazon sells much more than books now, you can buy basically anything you would ever want on Amazon, it's their identity as a bookseller that drove them to make the tablets.
I think it was driven by a realization that more and more reading was going to happen in these objects rather than on books. And if it was going to stay in the book business, it had to move into this new platform.
You've heard the expression, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
The practice by bars in the mid-19th century in the United States to give you a free meal if you had drinks. And of course, there was lots of salt in the meal.
The Kindle Fire's not free, but it's certainly cheap. And if having one of those makes you thirsty for more Amazon products, then the loss pays off. Zoe Chase, NPR News, New York.